Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. All right, so we start, as always, with our calendar for events of the month. We've got something every week this month, pretty much. June 7th, next week, is Ladies' Night, yep. And close the store early at 7 o'clock, unless you are a lady.
Yep.
Then you can come on in, and we are going to have Kelly Sue DeConnick Skype in and chat with us for about a half an hour or so.
Yep. Plus their usual chat and geek stuff and whatever, and we'll have, snacks, I think.
Yep. And then June 14th, that next Tuesday, is our Reading with Rogues. That's our graphic novel discussion group. We're discussing specifically Doctor Strange the Oath and Saga Volume 1 this month. So it's a Brian K. Vaughan. I'm sure we'll talk about other Brian K. Vaughan stuff as well as whatever people want to talk about in graphic novel world.
No, only Vaughan
stuff. Only Vaughan stuff. Okay, Nick has decreed.
prolific enough. We could fill it up.
So if you have not picked up Doctor Strange the Oath, you have a couple more days to pick that up at 15% off. And then starting June 1, it will be Saga Volume 1 will be 15% off. Or if you have a Rogue card, 25% off.
Yep.
Then on June 18th, we'll have Free RPG Day. I guess at some point we ought to... we haven't gotten our selections yet.
Yeah, we haven't seen exactly what we're going to get.
When we get our selections, we'll give you a sampling of what's coming out. I'm sure there's a Paizo Pathfinder thing and some other stuff. And then Saturday, June 25th, is our All Ages Awesomeness, which, as always, is one of our big events. We've got about six or seven creators coming in, signing and sketching, including our big guests from out of town, Babs Tarr and Joe Quinones.
Yep. I've, of course, been telling lots of people about it, and people seem hyped. I'm happy to know that we've been doing this long enough that people have, they'll be like, yeah, I took my daughter last year. She still loves that sketch of Michelangelo from the Ninja Turtles or whoever, you know.
Yep.
I hear lots of stories like that all the time. So, you know. To bring your kids, tell friends, you know, especially friends with families and young ones and young cousins and brothers and sisters and stuff to come out for it.
Yeah, this is our sixth year doing it, and it's trying to make it a tradition. So, all right, on to the news, and there's been some big movie news, but before we get to the movie news, I want to quick hit two bits of other news, which is Lord and Miller are doing a animated Spider-Man direct to Blu-ray, right?
Yes.
Who is?
Lord and Miller, the guys who did Lego Movie.
Oh, okay. Attached to some other different things.
100 things, yeah. So they're doing a Spider-Man movie, which is kind of exciting. The rumor has it that the Spider-Man in this movie is going to be Miles Morales.
Yes.
Which is cool.
You said there's an animated movie?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. So that'd be kind of them introducing him as a concept to the world at large, who is not the comics reading audience.
Yes.
Maybe set him up for some,
I mean,
from
he's already been in the Spider-Man cartoon that's on Disney XD.
Yeah.
Okay.
As one of the Spider-Man,
But this would be like a spotlight thing.
Yeah, this would be a spotlight thing
And maybe like a little bit of paving the way for at some point, you know, movie.
Well, and also it's going to be two of the guys who do a lot of great stuff. Yeah. Lord and Miller have a really good track record.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's exciting. And then the other thing that's exciting for me, it's not till next year, but Paizo has announced that they're going to be doing a Starfinder RPG. Which is basically
Pathfinder in space,
except it's not. It's more science fiction. It's based off the Pathfinder world, but it's not like you don't play space barbarians,
right? I believe they said you'd probably be able to use like stats for anything from Pathfinder for it, but yeah, they've rethought it from the ground up. It sounds like
the notion I think is to do something like what TSR did way back in the day with Star Frontiers, where it's like. You are an adventuring group, but instead of investigating dungeons, you're investigating planets. Mm-hmm. And instead of, you use a starship as your base of operations. There's going to be aliens. There's AIs. And they're tying it interestingly into, the Pathfinder world. Like, I believe the world you're based on is called Absalom, which is one of their big cities.
Uh-huh.
So it is sort of a thousands of years in the future of the world of Pathfinder.
Right.
So it's a world that had magic, probably may still. I don't know if in the future it will, but it sounds like they're doing a science fiction D&D, which I think is a great idea.
Yeah, yeah. I've read their little sort of, I guess, I don't know if it was an interview or like a sort of mission statement about
it. Yeah, it was from one of the designers who's a big fan.
But
yeah.
It looked cool. They already had good art up, and he was already talking about some of the races and classes and stuff, and they sounded really awesome.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it might be neat to, there have certainly been sci-fi games over the last 10, 20 years that have original properties. And they, some that have been well received, but none that have quite, I think, like fired the imagination of the mainstream gaming audience.
Right.
And this one, I think, kind of has that possibility.
I'm certainly interested.
Yeah.
I want to play a space barbarian.
I don't think they said you had, you didn't say you couldn't play a space barbarian.
I know, you kind of said that, and I was like, that's sad, I want to play a space barbarian.
You don't have like to play Thunder. A space barbarian.
Yes.
Although he was in a post-apocalypse barbarian, I guess.
Yeah. Right? Well, we're all in space, technically.
That's true.
all right, moving on to movie news. So Thor Ragnarok got a big cast announcement.
Hell yes, it did.
Yeah, and, it was a crazy, amazing cast.
And character announcements.
Yeah.
So notable, Nick, you know this better than me. Who's playing Hela?
Hela is
Cate Blanchett.
Which is amazing.
Then we have...
You don't know who you're in Norse mythology, it's the god of the underworld.
Yeah, goddess of the underworld.
Yep.
Then we have Jeff Goldblum playing Grandmaster.
Yeah, which I love this, by the way, because it means that this is the second sort of quirky Hollywood actor they've cast as the So basically, the Elders of the Universe in the Marvel Cinematic Universe are weird, quirky dudes. Yeah, like, the previous one was Benicio Del Toro's Collector.
Yeah.
And... if you don't know the Elders, the Collector and Grandmaster are two of the big ones,
they're
I think.
That.
Did the other ones get added in later? Like the Champion might have been earlier than that, but
yeah,
other than that,
I think
like,
he was a slightly later edition, I think.
But the other ones were added in the Silver Surfer
you
series
like
of the
those
80s.
Kind of like gods or semi-gods who like to toy with mortals and use them in their machinations and see whether good is greater than evil and pit them together.
I'm just waiting for the
other
scene that has Jeff Goldblum and Benicio Del Toro.
That's another
mouncing back and forth.
And there's the gardener. Do you guys know who else? The other ones? There's the one who's like the Buddha looking dude, and I can't remember what his name is. The Contemplator, maybe?
Is it Thanos Quest, the thing that set up the Infinity Quest?
Yeah.
It was a little 2-issue prestige miniseries right before the big Infinity Gauntlet, and it showed back in the late 80s or whatever it was, how Thanos got them. And he basically did it by kicking the ass of every one of the
what they call
the Elders of the Universe. Elders and you're right; they all had an affinity.
They were all in there, and he basically before he had the gems, he had to find ways to sort of outwit them and out connive them.
Yeah,
but they're powerful dudes.
They are.
But this of course begs the question of who you're going to cast as the other guys. And I'm saying the Champion, you got to find some 80s action star. I feel like Schwarzenegger maybe would be good for it, but somebody who's sort
that
of a quirky defined. Because Goldblum and Benicio Del Toro are certainly not the only quirky actors. I feel like Val Kilmer could maybe fit in there somewhere.
Yeah. Kilmer actually can play quirky. Yeah. I believe he's a little doughy, but he can hit the
base. I know. Jeff Bridges. Jeff Bridges is a quirky actor.
Yeah, I can see that. He could be the gardener. That guy always had like a big beard and stuff.
And Crispin Glover.
No, Randy. Not Crispin Glover. You got to break out Nicolas Cage.
Nicolas Cage.
Mr. Bean.
Actually, I gotta say, I think Crispin Glover might be a good possibility for somebody in
that
mix.
Sure.
Yeah.
Who is the one who's playing? I know they announced casting wise, but like that he is a character. But Scourge, the Executioner.
Oh, it's Carl Urban.
Carl Urban.
Judge Dredd
himself will be playing one of the like a big bad guy mercenary from Asgard who's known for a particular storyline in Walt Simonson's run.
It's 30 years old. I don't know if you can consider it a spoiler anymore.
I mean, it's the movie is called Ragnarok.
Yeah.
But Hela's involved, so we may see that scene.
Right. He dies in sort of on a redemption arc.
Yeah.
Having sort of had everything in his life taken away. You know, his one true love that he always pined for, the Enchantress, he finds out was just like always manipulating him. He does this amazing last stand on a bridge where he's literally holding off like all the forces of hell while Thor
with
and
machine
the other guys.
Guns.
Yeah, with machine guns.
I'm just saying, if you have him in there, you have to have Enchantress in there.
That's the thing. Enchantress is missing and it's weird.
It's a little odd.
There are ways that you could have him kind of... you can become a broken person without it being because the Enchantress broke.
And then they've
sure, but you need the Enchantress. Is Tom Hiddleston in this?
Yes, this is his last time filmed.
Okay, so Loki is in this.
Loki.
Okay.
Yes,
that's because he's going to go be James Bond.
It's possible. He's coming back. Anthony Hopkins is coming back.
Oh,
what's
okay.
her name? Natalie Portman is not coming.
Natalie
back.
Natalie Portman is not coming back. And they've announced. I forget the actress's name.
The actress from. What's the movie?
Creed, right?
Creed, yeah. Who was the love interest in Creed.
Oh, yeah, as Valkyrie.
Valkyrie.
I think she will kill it in that role.
And I feel like I've seen her I feel like I've seen her in something else besides Creed.
Which I guess she'll be a new romantic maybe with Thor.
With Thor.
Which is a cool, I like that idea.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, Ragnarok is shaping up to be just another one of those Marvel movies. You're like, can we watch it now?
And just remember, Mark Ruffalo is also in this because the Hulk is in it.
Yes, Hulk is in it.
Yeah, the one thing I'm not quite sure, in that Thor storyline, there was a Ragnarok storyline where basically, you know, demons and trolls and like giants invaded the Earth, and it was like all of Earth's heroes and everybody fighting them. They may well have some version of that.
They're leaving Earth out for the most part. It sounds like the majority of the movie is going to take place in Asgard.
It'll be like Asgard's undergoing Ragnarok.
Right.
I'm a little sad, even though we're getting all these cool thing people involved. Really wanted better Idril.
Yeah, me too. And it sounds like it's not going to happen unless they're saving it.
You know what? It's true. They brought him up in like if you found out about his people in one of the Guardians movies. You know, that they were, you know, mostly, you know, that their world was being destroyed.
I'm trying to remember where in the grand scheme of things. Is Thor Ragnarok going to be after Guardians 2?
I believe it is, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, Beta Ray Bill wouldn't make sense in Guardians. So, yeah, just because he's not in Thor doesn't mean we won't see him eventually.
Yeah, he would be, he could just be a guy who is trying to recruit for his, to help defend his planet, which would lead him to the Thor thing.
He could also be the post-credit sequence.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. Yeah.
They know people want that.
In the comic, the reason that they were in hell was because a lot of military troops died fighting, like American military and other guys died fighting the frost giants and stuff.
Right.
And Hela, like, sort of stole their souls rather than allowing them to go whatever their earthly afterlife would be. She captured them in her land. And so Thor and the warriors all go down there to get her, and that's where Scourge goes down.
Yeah.
And that's where Thor fights Hela.
That's where Scourge gets his machine guns.
Yep. And I've got to see the scene. You know, the scene I want to see is the machine guns. But if it's mostly on Asgard, they may not be able to do that.
They may not. We'll see. I bet they'll find a way to make it work.
They may find a way to make it work.
Again, Marvel Cinematic has shown a really good indication of knowing what the fans want and giving it to us.
Yeah. Well, even if it was something along the lines of, it's like, you know, this battle's not looking good. We had to, you know, but luckily Loki did a little bit of wheeling and dealing with S.H.I.E.L.D., and they've agreed to supply us, you know, and you know, you see them break out all this gear and stuff.
Yeah, Kate Blanchett's going to just eat up the scenery as hell.
Yeah,
she'd be great. If it's anything like the comics, she may also physically be confronting Thor.
Yeah.
We'll see.
And then, just announced, confirmed, this has been rumored for a while, Doc Savage is coming to the theaters. It is going to be written and directed by Shane Black. Okay. And starring Dwayne Johnson.
Now, we've certainly talked about Shane Black before, but for those who don't know, he's probably best known as the screenwriter for Lethal Weapon.
Lethal Weapon. And then, of course, he's done a variety of things. Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang. The movie The Nice Guys that we'll talk about later in the topics.
Most notably is Iron Man 3.
And Iron Man 3.
But he was also in Predator as the radio operator guy who told dirty jokes.
But I like to say, I don't like him being known for Iron Man 3 because even though that's his biggest thing, it's very divisive. Like, I don't like it, and I'm a big Shane Black fan. So
yeah, no, but I'm just saying, for name recognition, I think most people know him more from that.
Yeah, I just wouldn't want someone to see this news and be like, oh.
Yeah,
I want them to be excited that it's not.
I'm not talking that. I'm not besmirching Shane Black at all.
What we want is Lethal Weapon, Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang.
Yes.
And presumably,
I think everyone listening to this should go buy Kiss, Kiss, Bang, Bang.
I agree.
And watch it.
I agree.
Because it's an amazing film.
Yes. But so he is going to be directing. That was enough for me. Dwayne Johnson was not my first pick. He's a little. I'm not quite sure he's the perfect guy for Doc Savage, but people seem very excited about.
He usually portrays like these like badass types, and Doc Savage is that. But it's almost like that wrap around Superman or something like that. He's also supposed to be like a chemist and all that. And like, can Dwayne Johnson play this guy who's like supposed to be like super crazy smart and also a brute in combat?
Right, because he's very charismatic, but I've never seen him play like genius.
Right.
And I don't know if he's able to pull it off, but hopefully he will.
And of course, Doc Savage also always has a backup team, which I feel like Shane Black will do a great job with that.
Yeah.
They were kind of one of those quintessential, before like the Challengers of the Unknown and the Fantastic Four and all those other team, sort of adventurer teams.
Yeah.
These were kind of like the original one where everybody kind of had, like, this was the scientist, and this was even before the Ninja Turtles had a party dude, and
where
were the other ones? Doc Savage had the original team of quirky supporting characters.
Yep. I hope he has a turtle who loves pizza.
What was there? There was, like, Monk is one of the guys. I forget the other ones.
You know this better than me. I don't know Doc Savage that well.
And they're kind of like, depending on whether it's a period piece or not, they're sort of like, I think, sort of dated things like a radio operator, like a ham radio operator who was called Ham.
I don't know if it's going to be period. I hope it's going to be period.
I feel like there was, like, a British guy who was, like, you know, like a fencing guy, and he might have been named, like, Percy or something like
that.
But anyway, I think Shane Black will write a super likable and interesting cast of supporting guys.
I agree. And I actually think Dwayne Johnson's up to the job. I think he'll be great.
He certainly has the charisma down, and if the script is there, I think he'll come through.
Yeah. Okay, finally, the big movie news. Warner Bros. Has created DC Films to sort of go more head-to-head with Marvel, and they have put at its head executive John Berg and Geoff Johns.
Yeah, who's John Berg?
John Berg is an executive who's worked in film for a long time. He was involved with Edge of Tomorrow.
Okay,
he was involved with, I want to say Scott Pilgrim, but it's not that. He was involved with some smaller stuff but it's all got a good pedigree.
I was gonna say Edge of Tomorrow is a movie I really like.
Yeah, he's a guy who seems like he's got a decent pedigree as an executive, but the important thing here is Geoff Johns, and some people have soured on Geoff Johns. I'm definitely one of those people to some extent. But you can't deny that if anyone was going to be the DC's version of Kevin Feige, it was going to be Geoff Johns.
Well, he has been, like, say, shepherding the Flash TV show, right?
Yes.
Is he an executive producer or something?
No, Greg Berlanti is sort of the guy who's the head of all that.
Okay.
Johns has been involved.
Right. In any case, I believe we would all agree that the Flash TV show gets a lot right.
Yeah.
Getting anything right in the movies would be nice for DC.
Well, the notable thing here is that Warner Bros. Is just spinning off a division, basically. Like, DC Films is going to be its own thing. Right. That sort of implies that maybe the higher-ups who don't know comics maybe keep their hands off a little bit.
Right.
And that's really one thing they desperately need, is less focus grouping, less... Yeah. What if Superman was dark like Batman because people liked Batman?
Right.
Like, someone who's going to say... Yeah, people liked Batman, but you can't do that because
what people love about Superman.
Yeah, you need someone to do that part because that's one of the things that Marvel does. They get what's right about each character.
Right.
And Johns is a good person for that.
I think so too. I mean, Johns sometimes is a little on the nose with his characters.
I would take on the nose good as opposed to horribly, dementedly wrong.
Absolutely.
My biggest question is like, because, you know, I found there was interesting enough stuff and some enjoyable scenes in Batman versus Superman, but that's about the nicest thing I can say for it. It was still very much not what I wanted, and it's almost to a point where I'm like, can DC course correct, at least as far as like people who weren't liking that direction, as far as they go?
Well, you know where I stand on this, which is I don't believe they can. I'd like to like the DC characters again, but I believe that until there's a house cleaning at the top, a pretty notable one, all the way up to DC editorial, all the way up to Warner Brothers Films, I don't think they're going to get it.
I'll be curious to see. I do think I still think Suicide Squad has possibilities. My question is, like, we live in an era like where, you know, we talk about how they'll revamp concepts for film within 2 or 3 years of a concept flopping.
Sure.
They're back with like a new version of
sure.
it.
Sure.
And I would not, I mean, honestly, it would be almost wearying if they started from the ground up with Batman or Superman at this point. No. So I understand their desire to press forward and, like, maybe do heavy course correction.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a messy course correction, but I think it's something that we definitely need, and therefore probably everyone will kind of accept it.
You know what I think they need, and they don't want to follow in Marvel's footsteps. They don't want to be compared to Marvel, and I think the problem is that Marvel did everything right, so they should swallow that embarrassment and do it. And I think the secret is... Just like the TV show, the TV universe was built around Green Arrow and Flash.
Yeah.
Superman and Batman aren't in it. I think that the movie universe, if they really wanted to start fresh with their cinematic universe, they need to find a B-level character, elevate them, and make that movie first. The problem is, they've already done Green Lantern and messed it up. So I don't know who their B-level character is to do it with.
Flash could be it, but I'm not sure if that movie is going
to... And Flash has already been done in shows. I think that, unfortunately, it's going to wind up compared.
So,
I think it needs to be
Aquaman.
I mean, Aquaman is honestly not the weirdest call.
Yeah.
If they could make Aquaman really good, that could be the foundation of their new cinematic universe.
I'm trying to remember exactly where John said he was coming into the movie universe, because Suicide Squad's already done.
It's done. Batman is already underway. Justice League's already underway.
John said he was going to have some input on Batman.
He will, but Justice League's already underway. It's
right.
filming.
You know what?
And that's problematic.
But I honestly think he'll step in there, because Justice League is too big of a property.
You know what they need? Is a little analogy here. The first Star Trek movie, Star Trek the Motion Picture, stunk.
Yeah.
Some fans, I think, can tolerate it.
Dave, we should be fair. If you love 30-minute slow-mo shots of the Enterprise, you will love Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Lots of talk about the sentient clouds.
So, yes.
You're just going to compare DC Universe movies to Star Trek movies?
I'm going
to
say, for a lot of people, I believe Superman versus Batman was Star Trek the Motion Picture.
I've seen Star Trek the Motion Picture.
There was more explosions and stuff in it, but I don't know if it was any more capable of getting people excited for the property. But Star Trek the Motion Picture was followed by The Wrath of Khan, largely acknowledged to be the best Star Trek movie and a badass movie in its own right.
Sure.
You're saying Suicide Squad is The Wrath of Khan?
I'm saying it's conceivable. I don't think that'll be it. I think it's going to take a heavy... It will have to be Justice League or Flash or Aquaman or something like that.
Yeah.
But it is within the realm of possibility.
Sure.
I make all these jokes, and I'm maybe the one here who will be the most hopeful for these movies.
Yes, you continue to be most hopeful for all of DC.
Because I would like DC to be good.
I would love for DC to be good, and that's why I'm so disappointed.
And I sort of come to the conclusion that it will never be the DC that I remember. But if they can tell good stories in both comics and movies...
The trick that DC has always had to kind of run up against is by allowing their characters to be kind of iconic legends, open to lots of reinterpretations. It happens... It's actually harder for them, like, with Marvel movies, I can say, that's not quite my Spider-Man, not dead on, but it gets a lot that I know is for sure right about Spider-Man.
Sure.
But, like, say, somebody like Aquaman, he's been through a lot.
Yeah.
And, there actually isn't a definitive vision. There's runs I liked. There's eras that have been
interesting. He doesn't have a water hand. I'm not.
That's a good case in point. You have Peter David's Game of Thrones run.
Yeah.
You have the Aquaman the Barbarian from the 90s that was also liked by many. And then you have Geoff Johns' reinvention of the classic Aquaman as a little bit... more of like kind of an assertive guy, but not like a barbarian though.
Right.
I wouldn't know if like it's harder for them to do a definitive version.
I don't know about that. The core of these characters doesn't seem that hard to me. I feel like you could do it. It's relatively easy to get a good version of Superman. Whether or not you can get people to come to the theaters for it, that I don't know about. But getting a version of Superman that's good, that's interesting. It shouldn't be as hard as they're making it.
In a lot of ways, and we'll see see how it does when at its new home, Supergirl showed exactly how you can do Superman right.
Yeah.
She was more or less in a similar role to Clark Kent, and it was working very well.
Yeah. I mean, and it didn't do that great in the ratings, and some people found it cheesy. So maybe that's the lesson. Maybe I'm out of touch, and that's not what I want for Superman is not what people want.
That series could have been closer to what people wanted with stronger scripting.
Yeah.
A little bit more of the kind of cleverness that we associate with the Marvel movies.
Sure.
I agree. DC needs to just swallow it and say, okay, well, we'll do some of what Marvel does.
I do wish they could acknowledge that is just a good tone that Marvel has chosen.
But they can't. They just
sort of
can't.
Approachable. Geoff Johns might change that up.
I was going to say, why can't they?
Because DC, I mean, going back 30, 40 years, DC has
Wouldn't
never acknowledged
that, though. They'd but, be like, okay, Marvel. Even if they don't say Marvel has figured out the formula, I mean, just
Crisis on Infinite Earths, arguably their most successful re-envisioning since the original Silver Age, did bring a lot of Marvel to the table. There was a little more. There was Wally West, and even Superman had more of a little bit of a science fiction veneer to them. They became Wally was a much more Marvel type character. Than he had been prior to that. Prior to that, he was just a traditional kind of youthful superhero.
Is that why Wally's my Flash? Is that why I like Wally so much? Because he's a Marvel character?
It's possible. I think Byrne used to say that he made Superman into like a Marvel character when he took over.
That's interesting. I'd never even put it together because I've always thought I liked both. But yeah, I guess I'm more of a Marvel guy, even if it's DC.
Yeah.
Yeah,
well,
I don't know.
That's where I came in. I did, like, I'm not like a Silver Age guy in particular. For DC.
Yeah.
And their Bronze Age, though, that was, when they were getting into, sort of Grell, not Grell, the Green Arrow, though, and Denny O'Neil's Batman. And there were, like, I don't know that it's definingly Marvel to just sort of do a more mature take. I don't think that one was, but I think that sort of when they pin down personalities like that, I think that is kind of Marvel-y.
Yeah, I guess that's probably true.
But John's, I feel like if it has as good a chance as anybody of turning it around or sort of turning it around.
And John's is also a guy who, he's done some stuff at Marvel, but he's a guy, you know, there's some writers who feel like they're better at DC.
Right.
John's is a guy who gets DC.
Yeah.
He didn't. His Marvel stuff, I've only read some of his Avengers, and that was not
so good.
I agree. The weird thing is, like, I would have always thought Mark Waid was that guy, that Mark Waid was a DC guy.
Yeah.
But Mark Waid's killing it at Marvel now. So it's possible to make the switch. I mean, Kurt Busiek's a guy, I think it was mostly a Marvel guy, and his DC stuff's been mostly disappointing.
Mark Waid is one of the few writers who has been able to sort of bridge both.
Yeah.
Because he's done some amazing things at DC.
Yeah, he has.
But yeah, right now he's definitely killing it.
But I think in general people are good for DC or Marvel, and then they can do the other sometimes.
Geoff Johns did some crazy stuff in last week's Rebirth, and people seem to have liked it quite well.
Yeah.
So there's definitely some. He's definitely still got it to some degree.
Yeah. Well, we shall see. I'd really like DC's movies and comics again.
We shall see indeed.
And we will see whether or not I feel that way as we get to the comics talk in just a few seconds. All right, we're going to be talking comics for the week of Wednesday, June 1st. But before we get to that, we want to jump back to last week's comics a little bit.
Yeah, just a quick call out to the many exciting sellouts, I would say, and also to our I would like to thank the people for our very successful midnight release.
Yeah, we had a lot of people out. Some people played Injustice. I watched some son beating his mom up in Injustice. I watched Nick beat me mercilessly in Injustice.
Yep. People played the DC
deck building game.
And also, I liked hanging with people and chatting comic stuff with them. We talked about all kinds of cool stuff.
And we did a little bit of the podcast. Hopefully people enjoyed that. We had about, I don't know, 30 minutes, 40 minutes of podcasting with people from the store.
Everybody who was at the event eventually sat down.
A lot of people did. I couldn't rope everybody in, but I got a few people in. But yeah, so we want to thank people for coming out for that. We really appreciate it.
We hadn't done a midnight comic release in a little while, I think, at that point.
And this was a big one.
And it was big. Yeah, we had a lot of people show up for it.
And just as a heads up, DC Rebirth number one, despite us ordering what we thought was an insane number.
Right. We were like, this should cover us for like a month or two.
Yeah, this should get us through the summer. No,
3 days.
It's gone. There is a reprint coming. It should be here on June 8th, which is next week.
Yeah.
It will, of course, be regular comic price. It'll be $5.99 for 80 pages, which still a decent deal, but not as cool as $2.99. So if you got a first print, congratulations.
Yeah.
And we will be getting a sizable number of that second printing, so if you missed it, we will have that. And then same thing, Captain America, Steve Rogers, number one. We thought we'd have that forever. Then there was, I don't know, some kind of controversy. I don't really – nobody's talking about it on my page at all.
I haven't heard a single opinion on it.
Yeah.
Is it the Hail Hydra thing?
It might be the Hail Hydra thing.
Which, by the way, it's a spoiler, but USA Today and Marvel put on the front cover of their front page the day the comic came out, so...
I think every news organization in existence has run something about it.
Yes.
So, yeah, so that's...
That sold out, too. We did not know that one was coming. We knew it was going to be a first issue of Cap. They had not indicated in any way that there might be something here that might make people freak out forever.
Yeah. Which, by the way, people shouldn't freak out forever. It's Captain America. If you read the issue carefully, it's pretty clear what's going on. I didn't get it at first, honestly, but our friend John Sitton was like, no, it was this. And I'm like, oh, yeah, he's probably right.
Yeah.
So don't freak out. It's going to be back to normal. Cap's not a Nazi forever. They haven't besmirched the character's good name. It's all good.
This has happened before.
It's happened before. It'll happen again.
But I believe also just recently sold out was Scooby Apocalypse.
Scooby Apocalypse also sold out. There will be second printings on all of this stuff. We don't know. Scooby Apocalypse and Cap we haven't ordered yet, which probably means it's about a month right about the time the number twos are hitting. But we liked all those books, and they did really well.
Yep.
And it seems like the controversial reveal in Rebirth has going over better than I expected.
Wasn't controversial. Nobody's talking about it because they've made Captain America a Nazi.
Yep.
They're like, oh, who cares about a blue dude?
People just liked Rebirth.
Yeah, they generally it seems like it hit that hit an emotional reaction from a lot of people.
Yep.
And they did sort of feel like it was taking back the DC Universe, so...
And while we're talking about second printings, Future Quest number one, we'll get a second printing that will also be in, I believe, on the 8th or the 15th.
Yeah. And if you haven't read it yet, read that book.
We love that book.
That is an amazing book.
I believe what I get from this and Scooby Apocalypse's success is that if you are even kind of like a little curious about these, probably ought to just try the first issue for all four.
Yeah, yeah.
It seems like they're on a roll.
Yeah, what's next?
Wacky Raceland next?
AKA Mad Max Fury Road meets Wacky Racers.
Yeah, I'm excited for that. Then the Flintstones.
Yeah. Which I'm looking forward to a lot.
Yeah, I'm excited for those now, given how well the first two have done. All right, so now we're going to talk about comics this week, and the big thing, of course, is Rebirth starts this week, as does Civil War II.
Right. And Rebirth, in particular, the format that they're doing is after the there's the Rebirth special, which came out last week, which, although it does show how all of this is kind of the catalyst for it, shouldn't be necessary to read, I think, for these new ones.
Right.
I mean, I would definitely recommend picking it up when it comes out, but you're not going to be lost or anything.
No, no, actually, you can jump right into these. Are all, if you just like the character, you could pick up any one of these. It's not a big continuing story between them or anything. Yeah.
And so each of the major DC characters is getting a Rebirth special. Like, there's going to be Superman Rebirth number one, and then Superman number one.
And there was so much good stuff this week. We did not – all four of them are not amongst our picks. So Dave picked two of them, and we're going to just cheat and talk about all four of them at the same time.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct.
So, Dave, which two made your pick? Which of the ones were your favorites?
The surprise one for me was the Green Lanterns Rebirth special. Because I did not have any... I'd forgotten who was writing. In fact, even now, it's Jeff Johns and Sam Humphries. Mm-hmm. Sam Humphries is...
he's one of the guys who did a bunch of stuff at Marvel that we know. I can't remember. Did he do Avengers Undercover?
Avengers Undercover and Avengers Academy.
Which we liked, yeah.
I didn't have any strong expectations of this, and it even a little bit forgotten what the premise was.
And I will say this does have art by Ethan Van Shiver and Ed Benes.
I'm not a big Benes fan, and this is solid enough from him.
Yeah.
But I like Ethan Van Shiver's art, and it's pretty good.
I feel like they're delivering on the general quality of Green Lantern art that we've come to expect over, the last decade or so of Geoff Johns revamping it. And I was honestly excited, like, when the rings spoke in this.
Yeah.
I like when the rings activate and stuff, and there was some cool things that happened.
I mean, these are basically the two characters that are the buddy cop team, essentially.
Right. It's our two characters I might not be interested in on their own.
I actively didn't care about them when they were originally brought about.
I don't think anybody was a huge Simon Boz fan.
No.
He was the guy who I think was known as, like, sort of... one thing, he was, like, the Muslim Green Lantern.
And the Green Lantern with a gun.
Yeah, and the Green Lantern
with a gun.
He's a car thief. He was a kind of, like, modeled as a kind of... good-hearted car thief, almost more in the Fast and Furious style. Not almost. I feel like for sure that's what
stolen from Fast and Furious.
He was built on. Nick and I were saying that we thought that if he had like a crew of lantern ring wielding people that were like lower level lantern, that he gave out as his crew and they ran with it, it would almost be better, maybe.
Yeah.
But they did something surprising in this. And they teamed up with this the new lady who, what is her name?
It's Cruz.
Jessica Cruz.
And
she was the...
who only just got her ring, I gather, in like recent Justice League issues.
Yeah, her ring is the ring from the Injustice Society.
It's Power Ring's ring.
Right, so it had been formerly a bad guy's ring. But basically, it seems to be functioning
now... Defenders of Sector 2814.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I like what they did with Hal here. They make Hal sort of the dad and the elder statesman, and he comes in and he's like, look, the two of you gotta work together.
Oh, right.
He's also the mean captain.
And Hal shows up, that is an awesome... I mean, Shiver drew the hell out of that, honestly.
Yeah, it's a great scene.
That's one of those things, he can draw Hal.
But they're definitely... We've always talked about how Green Lantern should be... at its best, you want to sort of echo Space Cops a little bit. And you can get to on the nose, but the notion of sort of the bickering partners, one of them the rookie, one of them still a rookie, but feels like he's got the upper hand.
Right.
The sort of the bickering partners is a good mechanic for this.
I thought it was interesting. They specifically seem to be pointing Jessica or setting her up as like kind of like she seemed like an introvert person. She was all like anxious and like not. This is not her world.
Right. Yeah.
Like most superheroes, in a weird way, they're all kind of extroverted. Even if we're told they're introverts, they're all kind of extroverted.
Isn't it essentially giving a person who won't leave their house one of the strongest, most powerful weapons in all the world?
That sounds like a terrible idea.
I mean, but she was chosen, so...
And I like this. Well, she's talking to her sister, and suddenly the ring activates, and it's like, Lantern Jessica Cruz, code 109, unknown spacecraft has entered terrestrial atmosphere. It's that kind of, like, cop radio talk and stuff that I like, where it's like, oh, she's called, and of course, when she shows up on her first sort of call, that's when she bumps into Simon Boz, and then shortly thereafter, they all run into Hal Jordan, and I don't know, I like the buddy cop thing. It turns out... to be much more interesting, again, than I think they might have been separately. Yes.
So, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Design-wise, why does Simon Boz have a full-face helmet? Doesn't he have a public identity? I don't like that look.
I think it's probably in that same way that that Kyle Rayner did. It's sort of, and honestly, Hal at least has always had the Domino mask sort of effect.
I don't think he's got a public identity.
Does he not?
Really,
I thought.
About it.
I thought
he's working to an FBI guy.
Yeah, everybody seems to know who he is. So it's just a criminal. It's just that guy who knows.
I think that's the liaison for the U.S. government.
Oh, okay, that makes more sense.
Wasn't he in the Justice League of America, the team that was put together to take down the Justice League, if it came to it, I believe that is true. So he's been dealing with government types who have, and it sounds like they basically pardoned him for his crimes. They're like, hey, stop stealing stuff.
So this is an experience I rarely get, coming into a comic and being like, what happened here? Because I haven't been reading DC for like five years.
Right. And there's definitely something with like him and maybe informing on the Green Lanterns a little bit.
Yeah,
that was probably what they were planning to have him do, and I suspect he probably is not like, I'm not going to sell him out.
By the way, that's also a little cop. He's informing on his partners to the FBI.
Right.
I think there's some really good, great ideas, possibly great ideas in here. And I'm
looking forward to the foes that they dropped on the last page, which I don't want to say who it is, but... But basically, people who've been reading Green Lantern like off and on these past 10 years are going to find some interesting things going on, and a notable sort of opposite number for Simon and Jessica.
Yeah, of the four, this is absolutely the one I think was the best one of the week.
Am I continuing?
Yeah, go on. Let's just go through the Rebirth stuff all at once.
And then my other one, it's a week for Green. I expected that, like, I was really hoping that Superman would completely grab me, but I think I'm going to need to see the first issue to get on board that one, although I did like it. But Green Arrow Rebirth is my number two pick. This is the one where they are for sure kind of like, one thing just I want to say as an aside, this is New 52.
Yeah.
There's no doubt that the Rebirth special acknowledged that something had been missing, and that something maybe is kind of being restored.
Yeah.
The sense of legacy, the sense of optimism.
But this is not a reboot.
But it is not a reboot. Instead, it's sort of more of like an evolution and a slight tweak to things. What was it you were
saying? I've been calling it a course correction.
Yeah. Course correction.
And so what you have here, and when they course correct for Ollie, one thing that they seem to have completely adopted from his past, well, two things: Seattle location, and also the Ollie as Firebrand liberal.
Yep,
they dabbled with it the same way the show did, where he kind of went after the 1%, but he was not actively political, I think, in the show.
Yeah,
here he is a Firebrand liberal in the tradition that one remembers him in.
Dave, I think you mean three things. Because he's also got a goatee again.
He also has a goatee again, yes. He's actually, at the very beginning of the issue, is sporting a beard, and he gets called out on it a few times, and he decides to tweak it, and that's how we end up with the classic look.
Yeah.
This one has a backstory of, like, children being taken by these, like, kind of creepy, sinister types that are not usually, like, not typical of his foes, but I kind of like their creepiness.
I thought they were going to be vampires.
Oh, that's interesting. I think maybe just two on the nose.
And maybe they are. I don't know.
Yeah, there's definitely something.
There's something feral and weird about them. It's like an underground sort of semi-human group.
They're referred to like as the underground men.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Or is that just what the kids are calling
them? That's what the homeless people are calling them. The homeless people, they've been stealing people from the homeless.
But they look akin to something like the Court of Owls or something. A sinister group is that.
Right, right.
They look like Morlocks.
They seem more feral and Morlocky to me. Now, the other big thing in this is that they've reunited him with is Black Canary.
Yep.
And I cannot tell from this first issue whether we expect her to be a ongoing part of the series, a partner in the same way Green Lanterns is.
I think she may be. I think they're doing a partner book.
I hope it is. I didn't. This is also, by the way, it is New 52, so she is Black Canary, who is the singer. She's like a rocker.
Well, she was the rock star.
Was a rocker, yeah. Was that for sure?
I think she, at the end of her series, she walked away from it or something.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And that's why she's going to be like in Birds of Prey.
I like the idea that still is part of her life. I don't want him to drop it, because it is an interesting notion.
It was always a little weird for me to swallow.
I agree with that, too. She felt much younger, and here she feels more like... Well, she's much more feisty, kind of, and like they are almost adversarial in it.
Yeah,
they are not like there's not immediately hearts in the air.
But there's the spark.
They're flirting in that sort of they hate each other and then they like each other kind of way. Yeah,
and she does feel in some ways, even though this is that same one who was a rock star, she also feels a little bit more classic Black Canary to me.
Yeah,
which is a good thing. I think part of what DC is doing with Rebirth is like they're not necessarily saying they're not going to try and alienate their new 52 people who came on board there.
Right.
But they are, like, kind of rethinking some of them in the directions that people best love. And yeah. I think that's a good idea.
Here's my question. There's a couple things. Like, at some point, she seems to indicate... One of them sort of indicates, like, do I know you? There's, like, some of the knowledge is leaking through, maybe.
I'm not sure, because she outright said we've met once or twice. And to me, that seemed just a concrete acknowledgement that in the new 52
universe... I think you're not wrong. I think there is something of the old universe sort of seeping back in.
There's something where one of them has, like, sort of a deja vu thing with the other one.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
And the other thing I thought was interesting is that they talk about her past... That she grew up bouncing between foster homes, because that is not Black Canary's past in every other. She's always had a mom who was a superhero.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's going to tie back into the Justice Society stuff. If like the Justice Society was erased, and that's why she was bouncing in foster homes.
I think that's probably what's going to happen.
I think that's interesting.
Oh, yeah. Nick, I just came across that dude you were talking about when you were mentioning the Court of Owls similarities.
Yeah.
And that is a creepy looking dude.
Yeah, and on the next page,
is that
all
a mask or is that his face?
I think it's a mask.
I think it is. It's almost like the dude in Saw or something like that.
It also reminds me of the guys who were buying up criminal memorabilia in Black Mirror, the Black Mirror story that Scott Snyder did.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Right.
I also want to hand it to, is it Benjamin Percy? Is he the one who wrote this?
Yeah.
Of giving Seattle sort of a really cool kind of feel to it. Mm. And they do this, the homeless world, town.
It's like a homeless camp. Is that called anything real in Seattle?
By the way,
It's called the jungle.
Ben Percy should get some credit, but a lot of the credit go to the artist.
Right.
Otto Schmidt.
I don't know quite who to compare him to. He kind of has a stylish look to him, but it's who's the guy who did the punk rock Jesus?
Sean Murphy.
There's a little bit of Sean Murphy. Yeah.
I also see Francis Manapul, especially Francis Manapul's Flash and Detective Comics.
Yeah, yeah. There's kind of a and there's a little bit more, maybe a little more cartoony in some ways than the Vertigo guy I was just mentioning.
Sean Murphy.
But it's a very interesting mix. It's energetic. Like when they're in action, you can feel it. And like one thing that kind of sometimes bugs me about current comic artists. Is that they are very good draftsmen, but they don't always capture superhero energy for me.
Yeah.
And this guy I really feel does.
I actually think the design work on Green Arrow's outfit is really nice. I like the armored look, but it evokes sort of the classic feel as well.
Yeah.
And he's got the hood from the Seattle Day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Nick, you were mentioning something I like too, which and that this was very much the artist's work, I think. There was this like this homeless camp here in Seattle that spreads over like a few acres.
Yeah.
And again, I don't think this is anything close to reality, but it almost looked like they actually had like houses like in the trees and stuff like that. It
reminded me of like the Ewok Village.
Yeah, and you know, here's the thing: that sounds absurd, but when you see how this guy drew it, where it looks like a fairly ragged too. It's kind of cool, and it looks like it stakes out a different kind of Seattle. Like, you do see specific locations that are known
Seattle,
locations.
But it's Seattle in the DC universe, so it's a little amped up a bit.
Yep. And I hope that they continue to do that. I like Green Arrow in Seattle, but I also like DC's fictional locations. So
seeing
I like
back
them.
In Star City at some point might not be a bad thing.
Well, I don't mind if he stays in Seattle, but I wouldn't mind it being this heightened Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just real quick mention the other ones that hit.
You got the Superman Rebirth.
Superman
by,
Rebirth.
Peter Tomasi, and is this art by Doug Mankey? Is that
yeah? It's really nice.
And this is primarily a bridge between the loss of the New 52 Superman and the Superman from pre-New 52 having to step up and be Superman.
Yeah, classic
and
Superman.
Why he does that? They address sort of the elf in the room, which is is this Superman going to come back from the dead just like the other one did?
Which I think is a really interesting question.
Right. He like, the most famous story he had in the 90s was his death and return. And so when another Superman dies, you know, he is actually almost on a level of faith is like, he's going to return.
I also say this is not just Doug Mankey, it's also Patrick Gleason. So
okay.
Oh, okay.
Both of them
you know what's
together.
Interesting? I just realized that like many of these books, if not every single one of them, is in some way a partner's book.
Yeah.
Because you know who is it okay to say who?
Yeah, I think so.
He's talking with Lana Lang, who is the more, a little bit more, almost like, not quite an adventurer, but she's like an engineer in the New 52 universe, and she's very hands-on. In the issues I read that Greg Pak wrote, she played major roles in a lot of it. And it looks like
I was a little left in the cold, because I'd have never read her, the New 52.
It looks like she may be playing something of a major role in the almost like liaising between for the new Superman and maybe
You're right. There's a partners thing going on. She knows,
and because what the other book I'm going
to
mention.
Well, before you get to that, Dave, I have a Superman question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
You've been reading more Superman than me. Are there two Loises in the Marvel in the DC universe now?
I don't think so.
Yes, New 52. Yes, so there's the New 52 Lois and the other Lois.
That's true.
Because weird.
He's married to the one from the pre 52 universe.
So which one is going to be Superwoman?
I believe it's the Lois from pre 52 because I believe that's kind of how they're.
Are we sure the whole family's
going to
be super?
Yes, that's how they're going to get past the problem of like, well, won't your kids be threatened by villains
if they're all super?
His son is Superboy. His wife has powers. They're covered.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I think that's what.
And then
doing.
The other Lois will be the Star Reporter, kind of.
Yeah, probably.
That's
so.
Actually a pretty good way to do it.
Although this new Lois, I don't know what she will or like. When I say new, it's the classic Lois.
But she wasn't ever involved with Superman, right? Did she? She and Clark never got involved, or did they in their time they had?
Oh, I don't know, but I was talking about like pre-52 Lois.
Yeah.
I don't know what she's going to do like as her job, or if she's like going to be a mom. Like, is that her job? And occasionally maybe saving the world because she got superpowers,
right?
Well, that one remains to be seen. But this one does a good job, I think, of sort of bridging the gap and showing you sort of how this Superman comes to terms with the fact that there had been a Superman in this world. He's fallen. He wants him to not to have a legacy, and he wants him to return. But he's kind of like, it may not happen.
And this also caters to Peter Tomasi's strengths. I mean, it's very character-centric.
Well, you told me a lot about what he did with Damian.
Yeah, and basically, if you've loved what he did on Batman and Robin, I mean, this is the same sort of stuff. So, I really am impressed with his writing, and I'm excited to see where it goes with this. And then the last book that we're going to talk about
is Batman.
Batman.
A little character called Batman. Batman Rebirth. Again.
Another partner's book. This is... Scott Snyder and Tom King handing off, basically, Tom King is to be the writer. Scott Snyder is handing off, has one last reinvented villain for him, maybe.
Yep.
And they brought in a character from We Are Robins.
Yes.
There's our partner, by the way,
And you have a wonderful artist in the form of Michael Janin, who's been killing it on Grayson
for years now.
And he kills it here.
Yeah.
Do we want to say who the villain is?
I mean, people know it's Calendar Man.
It's a reinvented version of Calendar Man.
It is a creepy, weird version of Calendar Man.
Yep. He has the visual look, I think, Loeb and Tim Sale gave him as far back as Long Halloween.
Yeah.
But definitely they are kind of running with the creepiness.
And there's a weird twist to the character now.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've pushed him into not supernatural realms.
Superhero-ish, super villainish, I guess.
Yeah, he is for sure heightened at a level that will put him, like, As more of a physical threat,
he's like an X-Files. It's like an X-Files.
That's a perfect example.
And I have a feeling we're going to be seeing more of things like this, and maybe even more Calendar Man when Snyder does All-Star Batman.
Yeah, maybe so.
And that's what he's going to focus on all the villains.
I'm sure. Can he fix Maxie Zeus? That's the real question.
That's the real question. Mm-hmm. Well, Jim Gordon looks like Jim Gordon again. That makes me happy.
Yep.
I actually love the intro scene with him and Lucius Fox.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, I mean, that's right there. It's fun. It's not brooding. It's not dark. Yeah.
But at the same time,
Batman.
it's like kind of classic Batman, that sort of 90s animated series tone, I would say, where he's got, you know, he's dealing with villains who have an edge and a real threat level, but he himself, he's not like giddy with joy or anything.
No, he's still Batman.
He's also not morose and, you know, like this gloomy, sour Sam.
You nailed it, Dave. It's like the animated series one. He's dark, but he's still like, it's more in that arrogant dark. Mm-hmm. Like when he tells the guy, you know, tells his partner what he's going to do. Uh-huh. He goes and does it, and there's sort of no give there. He's like, you'll do this, I'll do this, this is what it's going to be.
Right, right. It's Batman who knows his stuff.
Yeah.
But I love the back and forth between him and what is the We Are Robin kid's name?
Duke, I believe.
Duke, yes. I like that notion. I like what they're going to do with that character.
Although there's still some questions I have as to exactly what they are doing.
But it's
with
something
him.
Other than Robin.
Yeah,
which is
it does seem
interesting.
Like it. Yeah, it seems like he may have a notion for something for a partnership, but that is still somewhat different. You know, just in general, you know, when we were watching The Flash and Arrow and stuff like that, one of the things we noted that they were really good at doing, which was building up a supporting cast to let the heroes. These are because Flash is a solo hero and Green Arrow traditionally is a solo hero.
Yeah,
but he gave him a lot of people to bounce off of. You know, a few key ones: Diggle and who's the hacker?
Felicity,
and all that. And then Flash has his whole Star Labs backup team. I feel like the DC might have learned a good lesson from that for their comics to take a lot of these guys who would the books that would otherwise be sort of solo books and give them some supporting cast members that aren't just the key ones that we've known.
Marvel did that with All New, All Different.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. Yeah, the sort of ensemble is a good lesson for everybody to learn.
Yeah, it's specific. They seem to be kind of specifically doing partners, which is kind of interesting, and we'll see if that runs through the other DC books. I mean, it probably is not going to be every single one, but it does sort of seem to be a pattern here, so we'll see. Anyway, it's a good first four issues to try out.
Yeah.
I honestly would suggest trying out all of them, but my favorites were the green ones.
All right, Nick, what is your pick for this week?
All right, my pick is Civil War II.
Number
Choose
one.
Your side.
That's right, all sorts of big stuff.
And it's still Team Cap and Team Iron Man, by the way. It's just Captain Marvel, not Captain America.
Correct, and I have to switch sides. I'm Team Iron Man.
I'm still Team Cap.
No, but honestly, this is written by Bendis, art by David Marquez, and it's a really good first issue.
It's a really good first issue. I am not generally a Bendis fan, but I'm liking Civil War II so far.
Well, yeah, we've been talking up the prequel stuff.
It has. We've seen the Zero issue and then, of course, the Free Comic Book Day issue. This one sort of opens with a pretty large event, gathering of heroes. There's a major threat, and runs from there. And it's really cool. Bendis does some great character work in here.
What he's generally good at is leading you into what, in this case, a sticky moral situation through character.
Yeah.
Can I say, by the way, one of my pet peeves? Not that I didn't have many this issue, but the one I had.
Yeah.
All the mages have their powers.
Yeah,
all I wanted was an editorial note saying this takes place before Last Days of Magic. That's all I want.
And there is sort of that I kind of was thrown by, that there's not really a reference to that happening. Or a few other things.
That is Bendis' biggest fault, is he's never worked and played well with others.
Yeah.
Like, he can set the tone for things, but he never seems to acknowledge what other people are doing.
Yeah, I was thinking you were going to say his biggest fault was that he doesn't use asterisks to make little notes.
Well, he plays well with his own books, because he definitely references things there.
Sure. Bendis references, builds his own little universe, but he's not great at playing in the larger universe.
Anybody can play with themselves.
That's a different discussion.
Oh, okay. Carry on.
The big thing about here is the new Inhuman sort of, and who has this ability to predict the future.
Mm-hmm.
And
it sets up some of the same moral conundrums, but in a kind of very uniquely Marvel way, as the movie Minority Report did.
Yeah.
And it's a moral conundrum that works, I think, in execution here.
Yeah. Well, we had a debate between staffers on it on the sales floor about half an hour ago.
Yep.
And we were all fired up, and we're like, wait, no, how can you not understand this side? How can you not understand this side?
And I think that's the good thing about it, is that both sides are represented well.
Yeah. That's kind of the thing that Civil War, the movie, did.
Right. And not really what the original Civil War.
The original Civil War comic was very one-sided.
But seems to have more in common with either the movie or the Secret Wars Civil War miniseries, which had some good thoughts on it.
Yeah.
But yes, this definitely completes the setup.
There's a couple deaths, which if you saw the Free Comic Book Day issue, you probably know what they are. We're not going to spoil them here.
No. But it bridges the gap between Free Comic Book Day, the Zero issue, and then we're moving forward.
Yeah, that's my other pet peeve, by the way, is I wish they didn't feel the need to kill major characters to set these crossovers up as important.
Which sets up my lone prediction about this.
Yes.
Which is that I think somewhat because of who those characters are, but also because I feel like Bendis, for whatever else he does, usually kind of approaches things from an unusual angle. I think by the end of this series, those characters will not be dead.
We'll see.
Bendis loves to kill people.
We're putting this on. David's putting this on record.
He does, but he is also, he's done it before, and I feel like he might change it up. Did anybody die in Age of Ultron?
Yeah.
I mean, die.
No, nobody died in Age of Ultron, right?
Maybe not die.
We saw a dark future, but the same way people died in the dark future of Terminator, and they stopped it all.
Right.
That sort of happened in Ultron. So I'm just saying, it's not a necessarily, and House of M also was all undone by the end of it.
So this is Dave's prediction. I told him he should get it on record on the podcast so that he can mock me and Nick.
Yep.
Because right now we're mocking him, because I don't believe that's true at all.
No, I don't think it is.
And I'll say, I do believe it is quite possible that they the deaths will also stick, at least for a time.
Yeah, for a time. I mean, that's why I'm not super upset about it, because all deaths get undone in comics.
They're both characters I like, one of them in particular, but I like them both.
Yeah.
Kind of the nature of comics.
Yeah.
I also want to say before we move on, David Marquez's artwork is beautiful.
Really good.
I think...
Yeah, just the page you're looking at, I like quite a bit.
I don't know which one of you guys said he was, like, sort of quieter artist.
I feel like his action scenes are a little small. It's almost like sometimes if you think of, like, superhero action as, like, cinema, and I feel like sometimes he stages it as if it were a play. But he's not... That's somewhat needlessly harsh, because he's a really talented artist, and it's not, like, that big a problem. It's a minor thing for me.
Here's my other question. Is that because he works with Bendis? Because Bendis writes play-like dialogue and story.
It's true.
And Marquez, if that's where he came... And that's where he came in, if that's sort of the pattern
Bendis
he's been in...
Bendis has always done that. His action scenes have always been...
He may just be working... I mean, that just may be the pattern that he's in.
But what was your thought, Nick?
He's a very concise artist, and I love the fact that he gives... this great sense of emotion to the scenes, because there's some scenes toward the end of this where if the characters did not have a certain look on their face, it wouldn't you know, carry that gravity.
Yeah, you need those you need the emotional weight to come through, and he does really strong expressive faces.
I don't know if it's on the level of like Kevin Maguire or anything like that, but it's very, very,
I think to me it is.
Evokes.
It's just that he doesn't, Kevin Maguire goes a little bit more into caricature, so his work has a humorous connotation, and Marquez, by not crossing that boundary of exaggeration, it keeps it kind of serious. It keeps it grounded when it needs to be.
Yeah. Overall, though, I loved this book way more than the original Civil War. I think people should definitely check this one out.
Yeah, and I liked it.
And I also liked it, which surprised me, because I was not expecting to necessarily read any of it.
Yeah, me
but
neither.
I liked all the prequel stuff, the Free Comic Book Day special, the Zero issue were really good. I think I liked the Zero issue better than the first issue itself, because I had a few minor qualms with how sort of they paced the action, like, because some of the big stuff had taken place in that Free Comic Book Day special.
Yeah, which is a little weird.
So, but overall, I have to say, I'm pretty impressed with the start to it.
Yeah.
This is much more what you want to see coming from a big event, and
yeah,
it's a very
agreed.
Good foot to get off on.
Yeah, I was planning to write this whole thing off, but now I'm in. All right, so I'm going to talk about a book I've talked about numerous times before, and the reason is, even though it's a big week, lots of stuff, I love this book, and I feel like it's not getting the right amount of attention. So this is your new chance to jump on board one of my favorite comics.
Serving you notice.
Yes.
He's watching you, and he's noticed you haven't all bought it.
Spider-Woman number 8 comes out this week, as well as Spider-Woman Volume 1, which is weird because there's only been two volumes, but they did the whole relaunch, which has the unwieldy title of Shifting Gears, Baby Talk. So this is by Dennis Hopeless, art by Javier Rodriguez. Rodriguez did a really great redesign on the Spider-Woman costume. It's got
really
that jacket that everybody loves.
Just get the mod specs.
So the trade paperback, if you want to go that route, has her basically pregnant and in a alien hospital under attack by Skrulls, where she gets to play sort of a diehard thing. And then also is the first issue of her being a mom. Great stuff. Really, really good. If you don't want to go trade paperback, if you want to try single issue, you can jump right into Spider-Woman number 8. You don't need to know anything about the character other than what they explain on the first page. And this has her going up against Tiger Shark, an old Namor villain, who has reinvented himself as a Staten Island crime lord.
Oh,
has spectacular artwork by Javier Rodriguez.
I was flipping through it, and I was that artwork was
Did they do a redesign of Tiger Shark, or does he look as crazy?
They did a redesign, and it's a great redesign. Javier Rodriguez, who by the way also does amazing color work here.
Yeah.
There's a bit where they're fighting out in the rain, and the rain is sort of causing this that color run you get from neon.
Right, yeah, it's like blurring all the bright
and
colors together,
it's
like noiring it up.
It's spectacular. There's a bit where Tiger Shark is backing up on her, or sneaking up on her, and you can see him, and it's just this great... It's staged really well.
In general, Tiger Shark is like a brute of a villain. He's like Namor level strength, and she traditionally is not really close to that class. So.
She's Spider-Man level strength. She's strong.
But I think of her as a lifts 10 tons, and he as a lifts like 70 tons.
Yeah, I think I put him in this list 40 tons, because that's where Spidey was.
Spidey's not a 40-ton guy.
Spidey's a 40-ton guy.
10 tons.
Get out your Marvel Universe.
We'll resolve this afterwards, and you can apologize to me.
All right.
record an apology.
That's right.
So, but at any rate, this has Spider-Woman fighting against Tiger Shark. It's really fun, and it has some of the fun stuff, the dialogue between her and her nanny, Porcupine Man.
Yes.
Or just Porcupine, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. And that was, speaking of partnerships, that has been that and her friendship with the
Ben Urich.
Ben Urich, the reporter who's long been an ally of Daredevil, but is a little bit the same way Rick Jones sometimes bounces around among his, like, who's his superhero bro. Yeah. Right now, Urich is pals with her, and it's that and Porcupine seem like a kind of cool little trio.
So there's great action, there's really fun wit, there's really funny dialogue. This is just, it's a great comic book, and I wish more people were reading it, because it is one of my favorite books.
So you know, like, if you come in and you're not picking it up, Randy is watching you.
It's true.
And he's probably expecting you to probably steal something.
He's making a list.
I'm making a list, and checking it twice. All right, my cheater pick is Paper Girls number 6, which is Brian K. Vaughan and Cliff Chang's very strange time travel-y 80s book. This is the new story arc picking up after the trade. And without getting too far into it, the girls have been, as one of them says, back to the futured. They have arrived in 2016, and they're kind of wondering what all these aliens and time travelers are about, and they run into one of their older selves in 2016. It's a really interesting, and there's more questions about the aliens' technology and if they're aliens or time travelers. This is a weird book, but it's a really good book, and I like this issue back quite a bit.
I'm behind on it, but if I know anything about Brian Vaughan, I would expect that even, you know, something that we would consider somewhat familiar time travel tropes would not really be executed in familiar ways when he's doing it.
No, this is definitely a new take on a time travel book.
Yeah.
Nick, what is your cheater pick?
All right, I'm going to talk about 4 issues.
Okay.
Because, you know, while that sounds crazy,
it's a mega cheater pick, but there's a special reason for it.
Yes, because it all takes place, 4 issues takes place in Deadpool number 13. And it is 2 issues of Deadpool, 1 issue of Power Man and Iron Fist, and 1 issue of Daredevil.
And the interesting thing,
I don't even quite know what it means.
And the interesting thing is, yeah, David Walker, writer of Power Man and Iron Fist, writes the Power Man and Iron Fist chapter. Yeah. Charles Soule writes the Daredevil chapter. None of the artists are from the main book.
No.
There's 4 different artists?
Yes, 4 different artists.
So 4 artists on 4 issues. It is essentially a crossover contained in one book.
Yep. And it is a 4-issue crossover in one book.
I, Deadpool hater, enjoyed this issue quite a bit.
What?
Yep.
He enjoyed it because it's got Power Man and Iron Fist.
I love the Power Man and Iron Fist chapter the most. If you're reading Power Man and Iron Fist, you should get this book.
Yeah. But honestly, the story is called Temporary Insanitation. a guy who works for a bunch of different crime families who've stolen from them enlists the help of Deadpool and...
To keep him alive,
which really is a bad choice, but whatever. And Deadpool, of course, then enlists the services of Matthew Murdock, greatest, what is he now? He's not a defense attorney, he's the prosecutor, goes to them because, where else would you go? And then, of course, Power Man and Iron Fist just get dragged in because, you know, they get dragged in. And craziness ensues.
It's really fun, it's got a lot of really good art.
It does, I mean, Paco Diaz does some of the art, towards the end. Elmo Bondoc.
Yeah, new artist to me, but I liked all the art.
Yeah, they're very good. And honestly, if you like Deadpool, it's a lot of nuttery, exactly what you expect.
And if you hate Deadpool, it's still good.
It's still good. But also a lot...
We're going to hit you say it, but the only 2 people in the entire Texas area that hate Deadpool are
in this room.
They're in this room. If it were to be blown up, Nick would be a loss to the community, but we wouldn't.
Amongst the many villains that are just sort of henchmen that are in here, Typhoid Mary is one of the big villains, and she's a lot of fun.
And she has an interesting history with Deadpool that comes from the Joe Kelly run, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah. Which is fun to see addressed.
Yeah, Jerry Duggan definitely is drawing on the Joe Kelly Deadpool, I'll say that. Yeah. I can tell that.
But, yeah, no, Power Man Iron Fist was fantastic in here, and I really enjoyed the Daredevil as well.
Also, it's $10 for a single issue, but it's $10 for what is essentially 4 issues of comics, so it's really cheaper than buying 4 issues.
Yeah,
so this was. I wonder if this was originally going to be a crossover, and they decided they wanted to keep it self-contained. I don't know how that came about.
Yeah, this is one of those things where you expected it to be like a, what is the reference term, where it was just a larger issue.
Prestige format
is what you expect a prestige format for.
I want to read it because I want to know what y'all were talking about with Power Man and Iron Fist swearing. It seemed to be something that was amusing you, but
you remember Nat the Hats?
Yes,
it's kind of like,
yeah, it's like that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And it's great.
All right. What else is on your list, Nick?
What else? I have The Punisher number 2, which I haven't had a chance to read, but I enjoyed Becky Cloonan's first issue.
That thing sold out for us like in a week.
Yeah, itself. We still have it, though.
Oh, did it?
Yeah, we got that back
okay.
in.
Okay.
I've got the fourth issue of the always odd but always satisfying to me, The Discipline.
Okay.
That's one of the ones that I'm for sure wanting to catch up on.
Has beautiful art.
Who's the writer on that?
It's Peter Milligan.
That's right. Peter Milligan's weird, supernatural, sexy time.
And artist Leandro Fernandez.
Oh, God, it's so beautiful. The 10th issue of Invincible Iron Man. I haven't had a chance to read it, but it's got Mary Jane on the cover.
She's drinking from an Iron Man mug.
Yeah, which I thought was kind of cool.
I like it.
The first issue of the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Pink miniseries. Focusing on the Pink Ranger. It was actually really, really fun. And the art continued. They find great artists for this, for these series.
It's interesting. I gather, I would imagine that the generation that grew up with the Power Rangers is now certainly of age and has like probably produced some really great artists. So I don't know for sure that these artists are like into it, but I imagine some of them are, that they are like, oh, finally I'm getting my chance.
And I did get a chance to read the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Bebop and Rocksteady Destroy Everything book. It was a lot of fun. And also has some seriously great art in it, which I was surprised by. And it's just fun. You get to see those two kind of just destroy everything. That is all that is on my list. Randy, what's on yours?
Dave, what's on your list?
You know, I think a few of these are ones that you read that I haven't gotten around to. So I think the only other one I kind of wanted to mention that I'd gotten around to before the podcast was All New, All Different Avengers number 10.
Yeah.
As you know, I hadn't been following the series. I randomly read issue 9, and I liked it. It was a one-shot. And issue 10 starts a new arc that sees them in space.
Yeah.
They're out there looking for Nova's dad, who I guess the one that had been on Earth was like, was it like a Skrull impersonator? Or
yeah, there
was
something kind of alien.
It was not a Skrull, but it was an alien.
It was definitely, yeah, it was like they were messing with the head. There is an awesome scene in this where you see, you know, Kamala Khan, Miss Marvel, is out there in space with him. She's never been in space before.
Yeah.
And she's just, her jaw's dropping just at being there. And she's like, I can't believe my parents went for it. And there's an awesome little flashback to them getting a call from Tony Stark. And he's explaining that their daughter has been selected as like the one of the finest young scholars for a top secret scientific field trip. And they're like, oh my God, it's Tony Stark. They're like, Kamala, pack your bags. It's just a great bit of a little comedic aside.
I also love that Miles Morales is freaked out being in space and is no less freaked out when Tony Stark tells them that without Thor power in the engine, this is basically just a box in space.
Yes. And I believe Miles is like noticing there's nowhere for him to swing around on. No places for him to do spidery stuff with. And ultimately, this leads to a new threat that I think is a neat idea that I haven't seen. Probably has dealt with, the Avengers have dealt with it before, but I can't particularly think of it, and I like the idea. It's not one of their usual foes.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say anything more than that, other than this is a good point to also check out the Avengers, the start of a bigger storyline and not just a one-shot.
Also, don't forget the Wasp team up.
And the Wasp team up, yes. She's having some... it seems like Jarvis has taken her under his wing and introduced the new Wasp to the classic Wasp, and...
That's going
to
be fun.
It looks fun, yeah. He's clearly going to have some fun with it.
All right.
Randy, the rest I'm going to leave to you.
Okay, so... Spider-Woman...
I want to mention that trade paperback right there.
Okay. Why don't you mention this trade paperback right here?
This was a formative graphic novel or miniseries for me originally back in the day. From DC is Legends. It's the actual 30th anniversary edition.
Wow.
So I was in my early teens, I guess, when DC... This was right after Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yep.
This was the series that kind of rallied all the heroes against the threat from Darkseid.
Yep.
The glorious Godfrey, in some ways, perhaps a demagogue for our times.
Presaged Glenn Beck to some extent.
But also with his pompadour of red hair, he might remind you of another demagogue who may or may not be running the country.
You mean Ron Howard?
If only, Randy. I would take Clint Howard if I had to. Anyway, but it was for me with John Ostrander writing, who would later go on to, of course, to great fame with Suicide Squad and more. And John Byrne on the artwork. This was always a crossover I liked because all DC's players were in there.
Yeah.
It was the first time I met Guy Gardner. Honestly, Black Canary, even though she's wearing her crazy 80s outfit.
I like the crazy 80s outfit.
I was telling Nick, I do too. And part of it is John Byrne did a great job of it.
Also, the classic Blue Beetle is heavily featured in here.
First time I met him, and I really liked him right out of the gate.
Shazam gets a big comeback.
He does. Wonder Woman, this was her first appearance to the public in there.
There's also the Suicide Squad, notably.
And the Suicide Squad, who... Right out of the gates, it seemed like Ostrander knew these guys were not everybody was going to make it back alive.
Yeah.
And they have a cool first appearance. I love how John Byrne draws the Phantom Stranger in
this
it.
This also set up Justice League International.
Yeah.
This was the rebirth of its time.
That's true. So yeah, a recommended flashback to the late 80s. In fact, you will even see Martian Manhunter assume the form of Ronald Reagan,
yep.
As crazy as that seems.
Yep.
But maybe not so crazy, given how often Barack Obama has been featured in comics. I think he was the most featured since Reagan.
Yeah, Reagan was heavily featured in the comics.
Yeah, he was in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
All right, Randy, that is my final break.
All right, so Spider-Woman Omega finishes up the Spider-Woman, Spider-Gwen Silk crossover. It's Dennis Hopeless writing, and Dennis Hopeless is the guy who writes one of my favorite books, Spider-Woman, so it's pretty good. They set up Cindy Moon of Earth 65, that's Spider-Gwen's Earth, as a big bad guy. The heroes have to team up to take her down.
Wait a minute, Silk is a bad guy on her world?
On her world,
Gwen's
yeah.
world? Okay, yeah. Interesting.
And she has different powers, and they explore that here. That's really fun, It's a really fun conclusion to a story arc that I've been up and down on, but I really like the conclusion. Amazing Spider-Man number 13, guest stars Invincible Iron Man, and the Tony Stark-Peter Parker rivalry gets off to a bit of a boil here, which was a lot of fun. I actually love the two of them having a rivalry. Miles Morales also features, as does the villain Regent, who is slowly but surely making his way into being the threat that we saw him in the Secret Wars series.
Interesting.
Really liked it. And again, still really loving what Slott's been doing with Amazing Spider-Man. All New Wolverine is number 9, concludes the story with Old Man Logan and Fin Fang Foom and Iron Man and Captain Marvel, our guest star. It's a really fun issue. I love this book. And they seem to be going in a direction where they're going to do a little more Old Man Logan X-23 story connection. Charles Soule has a book that he did a while back, his original graphic novel. That has been out of print for a while, so Boom is re-serializing it. It's called Strange Attractors. Mm-hmm. Has art by Greg Scott, who I've usually used to working in, used seeing in a sort of a painted mode. But this is a guy who's sort of a mathematician who sees patterns. It's got a little bit of that conspiracy vibe, a little bit of that everything is connected in New York. It's really interesting, sort of almost feels like more like a TV show or a movie pitch.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
If you like sort of like Person of Interest or something like that, I think Strange Attractors.
And
would.
I'm sure, no doubt, brought out because Charles Soule has been like has really been such a star. Lately.
He's one of the big stars. Yeah, Control number 1 from Dynamite is written by Andy Diggle and Angela Cruikshank, and artist is Andrea Muti, which I don't know the artist, but it's really
Hermione's cat, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. This is a sort of conspiracy espionage thriller set in New York. Its protagonist is a New York detective. It's crime, espionage, all the things Andy Diggle does well. Really, really good. Definitely recommended. And then the fourth issue of the much delayed but always enjoyable, The Goddamned, Jason Aaron's biblical pre-post-apocalypse book for Image. And then I also want to give a shout-out to a kid's book this week called S is for Superheroes. This is a big hardcover, what do they call this, board book?
Yeah, it's for very young ones.
For very young kids. It's got every letter of the alphabet, including a little diagram of how to draw it. There's little pop-up tabs. And,
they use the letter heavily in a sentence.
Yeah, and there's a picture to go with each one. I'll give you an example. Doctor Strange dodges the dinosaurs. So there's a lot of fun stuff in here. If you have a kid who is like just learning to read or just learning to their letters, this is a really fun thing to get them, and I was pretty happy with it.
And you can introduce them to the Marvel Universe.
Exactly. All right, that wraps up our comics talk for this week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about a variety of topics, including video games, podcasts, TV, and more. Okay, we've got a bunch of topics to cover this week, so we're going to jump right in. First of all, let's talk Preacher. Not the graphic novel series, but the show on AMC.
Let's talk about it.
I haven't seen it, so y'all talk about it.
All right. So, Nick, you and I both saw this.
Yes.
And I've been very skeptical from the outset of this whole thing. Seth Rogen's involvement.
There was positive word of mouth from people seeing advanced screenings, but we were kind of all, I think, like, I don't know if that's real.
Seth Rogen didn't seem like the right guy to me. AMC did not seem the right network. The trailer looked like nothing like Preacher. I got the sense that they were saying outright that they were going to change things.
It's true. That's the thing that got me worried the most was they're going to change things.
They did. I mean, yeah. This pilot is, if you don't count the characters being the same, it's like 10% stuff from the comic. It is almost entirely new events.
But I think what is cool about it is that the spirit of the comic is not changing.
It feels like Preacher. I was very happy with this first episode.
This kind of feels like what Garth Ennis would be writing now if he was writing Preacher now.
Yeah, well, and also Preacher was a thing of the time. It was in the 90s. There's a little bit of that macho kind of thing that doesn't fly as much anymore.
Right. And it was also, it was very Tarantino influenced. Yeah. I'm sure there's still like
there's big definitely still Tarantino influence.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, you know, you were mentioning Ennis. I saw, like, on DC's website, he was talking about it, and I kind of assumed he wouldn't get in the camera at all for this. I kind of thought he would get a paycheck and then kind of quietly let them do whatever.
No, he's talking it up.
And he seems to be really enjoying what they're doing, was saying that he thought that the stuff that they changed made it, you know, really work for TV.
Yeah.
And that he was like, how excited he was when the first time he saw what's his name as Jesse.
Yeah.
Well, I honestly think the biggest and probably the best change of the entire show, all of the first episode so far, is the Tulip character.
Tulip. Ruth Negga from S.H.I.E.L.D.,
yes.
Who I always liked, even though I thought she wasn't getting particularly good writing.
Right.
She kills it as Tulip.
She kind of creates Tulip in a new, you know, you see her in a new light. I mean, she was supposed to be kind of a badass in the comic, but you never really saw it.
Yeah, it almost felt like she sort of fell into the hit woman thing.
Yeah.
And here it's like, no, she builds a bazooka from kids' toys and takes down an attack helicopter.
Yes, and that's pretty badass.
That is some bonkers craziness.
It is bonkers craziness.
Well, and that scene is bonkers crazy, but it's also endearing in a way, because I don't know. It's just really, really fun.
It's a fun scene, and her sort of interaction with the kids on that is really good.
Yeah, it's the kids and the kids seeing this action through their eyes.
And she's sort of joyful about it. Tulip, when we meet Tulip in the comics, she's kind of broken and dark and
depressed
and angry and. The because they're doing sort of different thing, they're setting the thing in Angelville, Texas. Is that what it's called?
Yes.
Anvil, Texas. Because they're sort of setting that as their base, which makes sense in a TV show. You can't have a road movie. You've got to have standing sets. You've got to have standing supporting cast. So Sheriff Root is his town sheriff, where he's Preacher. And Arseface is part of that, too.
Yep.
And Tulip lives there because her uncle lives in this town. So the two of them aren't, like, estranged and meet up randomly. They've had to make peace with the fact that they broke up.
Right.
Interesting.
And
these are pretty big changes.
And Cassidy literally drops into town.
That's true. He does.
Because he's a vampire and he can survive a fall from 30,000 feet.
And that was actually one of the bigger, I mean, another big change.
What was
that
he falling from?
From a plane.
Okay.
And how Cassidy sort of meets everybody.
Yeah.
And why he jumps out of a plane is kind of a big change for
the
comics.
The thing I think is interesting is that there's the Grail that we know is hunting down Jesse because we see them. And by the way, did you notice?
Oh, yeah.
Every time they show up in a town, they're dressed in the most stereotypical manner possible.
Yes.
So when they show up in Africa, they're dressed as like colonial explorers. When they show up in Russia, they're in the big fur hats.
Yep.
When they show up in Texas, they get the big belt buckles.
So they're carrying some of the kind of broad humor that Ennis does, although it sounds like a little different, though, too.
And I have to say, one of them is Star. Right?
I'm pretty sure, yes. One of them is Star.
He looks very much.
And the thing is, I don't know how they're going to delay him meeting Jesse because it seems like he's found him.
Yeah.
So one of the other big changes they do is that before Genesis enters Jesse, he tries to find some other religious figures to sort of host him. And he's sort of too pure for them or something because they all explode.
Yes.
It opens with an African preacher giving sort of a big, inspiring, sort of little fire and brimstone-y.
Yeah.
And then he explodes.
I think the host that he tries first just have too much God in them.
Yeah. Well, and then there's a hilarious mention about Tom Cruise. Because Tom Cruise Scientology. So, so it feels like Preacher. But the thing I like about this, the Grail was always Jesse's bad guy. Like, Tulip and Cassidy were sort of along for the ride. But it seems clear to me that the Grail are vampire hunters.
I think that's like, a part of them.
That's who the Grail are. I mean, that's part. So the Grail is hunting Cassidy, too.
Yes.
And I'm guessing the Grail is the kind of organization that would have an attack helicopter. And I think that that's what Tulip was involved with, too. So basically, they've tied all three main characters into the main bad guy.
Yeah, that's pretty clever.
And that's really good. That's something that I think if Ennis could go back and do it again, he would have done.
But yeah, as he was doing it, because of that Tarantino influence, it felt a little bit like the way the paths crossed in Pulp Fiction when he wrote it.
It just did.
Kind of strange coincidences.
Yeah.
And I will say Dominic Cooper, of course, is amazing as Jesse.
Yeah, it's funny. Dominic Cooper is the most grounded performance. Like Jesse is the most grounded performance because Cassidy's over the top and great over the top.
You can
and
understand Tulip's, every third word that he says. Yeah.
And Tulip is sort of over the top. And the guy playing Arseface,
yeah.
He's great. Under that makeup, he's doing a great job of giving him that sort of that the damage that he's done, the sort yeah. of the sorry feels, but also that optimism that he had in the comics. Like,
right, he was almost like comically optimistic yeah, at times.
He's a really likable character.
Honestly, I think all the characters and actors they have yeah. are likable.
What, yeah. what y'all have said has made me want to see it, where I kind of was indifferent before.
I really liked it.
It's also as violent as can be.
Yes, yes.
I assume, but they can't swear, right? Like, not the level, they can't drop the F-bomb.
They drop the F-bomb in the same way Breaking Bad would do it. They can drop the sound out.
Right.
And, or they have something interrupt. Yeah. And they're pretty clever about it. Like, okay. It's pretty profane.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, I don't know where they're going to go with it.
They dishonored Garth Ennis if they didn't at least try.
It's also beautifully shot.
Oh, yeah, it's gorgeous.
The cinematography, I have to say, is...
Like, desolate Texas stuff?
Yeah,
or
there's that,
it...
but there's just the framing of certain scenes. Mm-hmm. There's especially one with Jesse walking out to the sort of the road, and you can see his church in the background.
Yeah.
Kind of this desolate piece of Texas landscape.
Yeah.
And it just... It's sort of evocative of the character. Because
okay.
that's sort of where... His mindset is, and that's how he feels. He's sort of just set aside just by himself and has no, he's so depressed.
Well, the showrunner on this is a guy who ran a lot of, who was involved with Breaking Bad at a high level.
Okay.
So that tells you a lot. I'm really excited about this show.
I am too. I was really sad
not
that
where
it was,
I think we thought we'd be
no,
a year ago.
No, not
I
at all.
I was very sad it was not on this weekend.
Yeah, me too. I'm ready for episode two. all right. We're going to revisit a podcast that Nick had already talked about and talked both me and Dave into.
Basically, we just need to say he was right. Everybody watch it.
Listen to it.
No, watch it.
The Bright Sessions, which is... Dave, how far are you into this?
I'm like 12 episodes in.
Okay.
And I liked it from the beginning, but had like a few qualms with it. Like,
yeah.
As with a lot of these kind of podcasts, they're somewhat based in reality. I had to get a little bit used to a slightly heightened style of acting.
Sure.
But not too high. But like, as the twists have kind of come, I'm like, it's interesting right from the get-go.
Yeah.
But as the stories have started to build a little bit, some really interesting stuff has happened lately, and
yeah.
I've really liked recent episodes.
Yeah, I'm digging. I'm caught up. I believe
yep.
Nick is also caught up.
Yep.
And yeah, when they start sort of crossing the characters over a little bit, but basically, Bright Sessions, for those who don't remember, is it's a psychologist who is talking to what they call atypicals.
Yes,
yeah.
Atypicals,
which are basically people with superpowers in a world that's where it's kept secret. And her main patients, there's three main ones. Chloe, who is a telepath.
Yep.
And
Sam the time traveler.
And she sort of vanishes into time and then comes back.
And Caleb the empath.
And there's another one, but we won't spoil that.
Yeah.
But
and it's, again, this is not like a world with superpowers as a known thing in it. This is more or less our world.
It's more X-Files. It
right.
really is.
It's as if she, as you know, she herself, Dr. Bright, is something of a mystery as to how she knows about it. But things are unveiled a little bit over time as to why she might have this particular interest.
Right.
And what you're hearing is these rather interesting therapy sessions that kind of tell you, give you a suggestion. They approach these powers in different ways.
Yeah.
It didn't sound interesting to me when I heard about it. I was like, okay, even in an interesting way, I've seen a million telepaths in movies. I just
sure.
don't have the interest in this. But I'm glad I tried it out because I really ended up liking these characters.
Yeah, there's some really clever, like, because they're talking to a psychiatrist, there's a very clever discussion of exactly how powers feel.
Right.
And that I don't think we've seen anywhere before.
Yeah, just as an example, and we might have brought this up before... at some point when I think Caleb is talking about different emotions, he uses a color analogy.
Yeah.
And he's like, sometimes I'll see people whose color and it's like is like blue.
Yeah.
And then I'll like talk to somebody else, and somebody else will be in the room and they're emanating emotions that's like yellow, and it's almost that yellow and blue make green thing, and it becomes like a third thing to it.
Yeah.
And all the powers are kind of lensed in this really interesting way where you're like, oh, wow, it's not just like, as it's often depicted in comics, where the telepath only has to deal with, oh, there's too many minds, I must, you know, that it's overwhelming me. They think about much, much more interesting things in this show.
Yeah, I agree.
And the way this story begins to unfold is really cool.
And the story does kind of open up, and there is sort of a definite direction.
There's
for
a real
it.
There's a real story here, in the same way there is with Black Tapes and Tannis. There's an ongoing arc, and I really, the more I listen to it, here's an interesting thing. I started backing this on Patreon, and in doing that, I discovered this is a relatively new and small show. She records it in her bedroom in New York.
Wow.
Yeah, this is, and it sounds totally professional.
I was going to say it's very slick sounding. It does not seem. I would not have guessed small production.
Me neither.
And I would say that the voice acting is some of the best I've heard so far.
I like the voice acting. I also like that it's 15-minute episodes. I love the shorter episodes. Ironic that in our like hour and a half show, I'm talking about how much I like the best podcast, but you know.
We're working at it. I'll be Dr. Bright.
All right. So, Dave, I want to talk about a card game that you were playing, Cthulhu Realms.
Cthulhu Realms, yeah. Well, as I don't know if I mentioned this previously, but I've been getting way into Star Realms lately after playing it at our game day.
Yeah.
And so I've been playing the tabletop version of that. I've been playing the app.
The iPad app, yeah.
I was going to say, I think you and Randy have staged many a battle.
Yeah, we've been playing quite a bit.
Yeah, Randy's won too often for my taste. But we'll fix that. More recently, for we just got back in Cthulhu Realms, put out by the same creator of Star Realms.
Yeah.
And it was one of the things I got from my brother for his birthday, and so we played it that day. And I ended up really liking it. It's different from Star Realms in several different ways, but I would say people who've played Star Realms will be familiar with the basic concepts of it. It's almost like your rival cults in this, and there's sort of three different factions. There's like the King in Yellow. There's Cthulhu himself, and like he'll like they have color based cards, sort of the same way they do in a lot of these deck building games, but like. Yellow for the King in Yellow, kind of green for Cthulhu, but also for locations like Relia. And the locations work somewhat similarly to how like bases do in Star Realms. And then I forget what the other one was, but I think it may be like sort of Miskatonic University cards. But you're sort of trying to build a hand of monsters, artifacts, locations, and stuff, and eventually decimate your opponent.
Okay.
One of the biggest differences, at least if I remember correctly, Cthulhu Realms, it's a 2-4 player game, whereas Star Realms is just 2 players.
Correct.
Right?
Correct. Although I have only played it as a 2-player thing, so I can't quite speak to how it plays as a multiplayer game.
Right.
It was close enough that it's a little hard for me to quite imagine it, but I don't know if that means more ganging up on certain players, if you know, you'll kind of turn on each other.
Well, Star Realms can expand to 4 as long as you get another deck.
Right, right. It's true.
So, yeah, you can expand Star Realms.
For artwork, they use a kind of tongue-in-cheek style of artwork, which is kind of a fun change-up from the doom and gloom of Cthulhu. I would somewhat liken the art on it to, who's the guy who draws Chew?
Tony, no.
To Rob?
Rob Guillory.
To his style... the King in Yellow, I believe, actually shows one of those. There's one of the related things you can get is the yellow sign.
Okay.
And the yellow sign in that look is like one of those wet floor signs. The little plastic yellow signs that you will see any place where they're mopping in a restaurant. But like it has like the sigil on it, so they use a lot of visual humor and stuff like that. Their cultists are these like big Warner Brothers looking thugs. I mean, they're not cultists, but they're gangsters and stuff. But I really liked it. It is, I feel like anybody who's played Star Realms, and that's a lot of people at this point, should give it a try as a change-up. I'm blanking a little bit on some of the minor mechanical tweaks that it has, but it does have some stuff that definitely makes it uniquely its own thing. It plays pretty quickly, probably 20-minute games or so, not unlike Star Realms in that sense. But it's different enough that I feel like it definitely has value. So Lovecraft fans, Star Realms fans, check it out.
All right. I want to talk about a movie that I saw this weekend, which I'm sure you guys will both be seeing eventually, which is The Nice Guys by Shane Black.
Yep, as previously discussed,
yes.
Shane Black.
Shane Black writes and directs. It stars Russell Crowe and Ryan Gosling.
Yep, pretty powerhouse.
And basically they are – it's set in 1977 Los Angeles. It is sort of 70s noir, basically.
Okay.
It centers around a pornographic film – a murder, a missing girl, and Russell Crowe plays a professional leg breaker who has sort of a heart of gold, and Ryan Gosling plays sort of a sleazy private eye who's actually got the private eye skills. They wind up teaming up. This has all of Shane Black's hallmarks, which is sort of a complicated noir plot. Lots of humor.
Banter.
Violence when you least expect it. Plot twist when you least expect it. A lot of witty banter.
I've got to ask, any Christmas mention?
There is a Christmas nod. there's a precocious child.
Okay.
Which is another thing that he doesn't always do, but he does very often. Iron Man 3 had it.
Yep.
Last Boy Scout had it. This has it.
Last Action Hero had it.
Last Action Hero. I forgot that was Shane Black.
Extra Squad, you could say, had it.
Yeah.
It's true.
It's very much Shane Black does what he does. If you like that, then you definitely should go see this movie. If you don't like that, I don't know if we can be friends.
This is probably, am I correct in hoping that its closest spiritual predecessor would be Kiss Kiss Bang Bang?
It's pretty close to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, yeah.
Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is one of those movies that's, it's a sleeper movie as I can think of.
Yeah. Because,
like, nobody watched it when it came out.
Yeah.
But every single person I know who's watched it since has been like, man, that movie was amazing.
Yeah.
So, A, people should watch Kiss Kiss Bang Bang.
Yes.
And B, people should probably catch,
Go see The Nice Guys.
The Nice Guys.
I already kind of want to see it again. all right. And then I also want to talk about another thing that I'm late to, but I finally listened to the Hamilton soundtrack on Spotify.
Yep.
If you guys don't know, Hamilton is the hip-hop musical. It is so popular, like, you can't even, if you're rich and famous, get into right now in New York.
It swept the Tony Awards?
The Tonys, yeah. It is about Alexander Hamilton. And
obvious topic for hip-hop.
It reveals stuff I didn't know. It's a whole story. Like Book of Mormon, which I still haven't seen, but I've heard the soundtrack over and over again. You get the story from listening to the music.
Right.
And the music is great.
I'm kind of glad you mentioned this, because I was sort of thinking I'm going to see this probably when they make a movie out of it or something like that, or do some big TV production in 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
Am I just misremembering, or was this guy on John Oliver?
He was on John Oliver.
Okay, yes,
because he's from Puerto Rico, I believe, and so he was there for the Puerto Rico
episode.
Right.
Oh, okay, yeah, I saw that.
He also had a guest shot on Amy Schumer this year, so
okay.
He's definitely one of the it guys. But it's really great music. It definitely tells you a story. It makes you want to learn more about the character, learn about Hamilton and his history, which is
not
quite an accomplishment.
You expected to say, yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really good, and I definitely recommend it. If you don't have Spotify, I'm sure you can buy the soundtrack, but if you do have Spotify, it's basically just part of your already paying subscription, so check it out.
Okay, cool.
I would definitely recommend it. All right, and we already talked about the beta, but I real quick want to drop in on Overwatch.
Yes, I picked this up as well, so
yes.
I can talk about it.
I guess people like this game.
We've both been playing the hell out of it.
You've been playing the hell out of it more than I have.
Yeah.
But I am loving what I have been playing. So,
yeah.
What level are you? I'm
level 21.
Okay. I'm level 12.
But the great thing about this is the levels are a good indicator of how long. Like, last time I played with a couple guys who were level 50.
Yeah.
And you could tell they were level 50 because they were playing like experts.
Yes.
But all that is an indication of how long you've been playing, because all the characters are unlocked from the outset. There's no abilities to unlock, no weapons to buy.
And it's not like you're going to start the game and be like, well, this will get fun when I get to level whatever.
No,
it's
just,
like, it's cool right out of the gate.
And there's practice. There's a practice area. There's a play versus AI. If you want to scale up, you can easily scale up and then jump in against other players. So it's got a good learning curve, better than even Battlefront that we all liked, but Battlefront, you know, you had to deal
the
with people.
The missions were not great.
And you had to deal with people getting more gear than you.
Right.
Sure. Overwatch is, because it's sort of superhero based, all your powers are there from the outset, and there's a great mechanic where you can test each one out. You can pull it up in game. You press a button and it pulls up what your abilities are.
Yeah.
It's indicated very clearly. Like, I had no trouble figuring out what I was doing here.
No, but there is sort of a level of figuring out a character.
Sure, I'm still figuring out all the characters.
I'm still figuring out all things. There's people I'm good that I can be good with, but I don't feel like I use them to, like, their best potential.
Sure.
And a lot of this game is fun regardless of anything, but once you find a group or you get a group together that you can work together,
yeah.
I think this game works the best when you're working as a team instead of working solo.
Yes, it absolutely is a team game. And also, when you're playing against people who are good and you watch their moves, then you steal their moves.
Well, yeah, of course.
You're like, oh, I know where that place on the map is now. I know when to deploy this attack, you know, all that kind of thing. But I definitely love the overall feel of the game. It's got beautiful maps, really well designed, great character designs. And when you level up, every time you hit a level, you get what they call a loot box, and you go and you open the loot box and you get everything that you get. I think, what, four things at a time, Nick? Four or five?
You get four.
Okay. And they're little discs that pop out, and what they give you is new skins, because every character has a variety of different skins.
Right.
new what they call sprays, which are little spray paint you can put on the walls. There's a ton of those. New voice lines, new opening poses, new opening closing poses.
That's cool.
It's all not material, decorative is the word I'm looking for.
Ornamental?
Yeah, something like that. It's
Like, in other words, it's not going to affect how awesome you are in the game.
Yeah.
You don't. It's not like you're getting a bazooka and everybody else has a pistol. You're getting a, but you're getting access to cool skins and stuff that'll basically, as you play it longer, you're going to enjoy just seeing some of this variety and new lines and all that.
The cool thing about this is you can, from the beginning, when you put the disc in, go and see every skin, every voice line, everything the character has. You can't use them yet, but you can see all of them.
Right.
So that's not unlockable. Like, that's in there from the beginning. And then when you unlock, it's random.
Yeah.
So, like, I randomly unlocked one of the rarer skins for Junkrat, I think.
Oh.
or no, for Road Pig. Because it's just you get it randomly. And you get colors. Like, there's a purple disc and a blue disc and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah, you don't necessarily – you don't have to work your – you don't have to grind your way through all of them.
No.
You just get randomly. You might get a really super cool skin on your second level.
Nice. I do have a question for as someone who hasn't played the game.
Yep.
What is the learning curve as compared to, say, Star Wars Battlefront?
Easier? Yeah.
Because I know on Star Wars Battlefront, I definitely felt like I was getting my butt kicked for longer than I might have liked.
And I think one of the biggest draws for this, as opposed to, like, Battlefront, is the... There's a really... You know, not a learning curve, but sort of a... there's tons of characters. And
yeah.
I still haven't touched, like, half of them.
Yeah, I'm still working on a couple that I've barely played.
And I think it's just fun to sort of feel them out and learn their sort of personalities and moves. And Battlefront is really just run and shoot.
Yeah, there are 21 different characters. They all play differently. So there's four healers, but they're all different styles of healers.
I assume they all interact with each other in interesting ways.
And they all interact in interesting ways.
Some people have to be like good combos. And,
Yeah. If you match a Reinhardt with a Mercy, that's their big tank dude with a healer.
And I will
you become really tough.
I will say, if you do get killed, their tips that come up are actually really
they're really
good
handy.
Tips.
They'll explain to you the weaknesses of the guy who just killed you, like, here's how you avoid that death again.
Oh, that's cool.
Or here's a way to do this better.
Like, that's a small but really notable
basically, thing. Basically, like, Reinhardt can create this giant shield, and they're like, get your friends together, blow out the shield, or make him use, like, one of his drives that sort of, you know, because every special move that you use has, like, a... It takes so many seconds to sort of come back to you.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think his comeback, like, slower than anyone else's. So he's a powerhouse, but he's definitely got some flaws. Everybody's got pluses and minuses.
Yeah. There's a great world here.
Yeah.
Like, just the hints. If you go online, you can see the profiles of all the characters, the histories. And when they – sometimes in the opening, before the door unlocks, while you're all just gathered together ready to get out to the battlefield, they'll talk to each other.
Yeah.
And they interact differently. So, like, Hanzo and Genji are brothers.
Yep.
And one of them will say, you know, I will redeem myself. And the other one will say, we will see, brother. And, they all talk to each other.
That's cool. You know what that reminds me of? In a more freeform version of what I really liked about Left 4 Dead.
Yeah.
Which is when you were in the safe rooms, the characters would chat. And it did change depending on who was there.
Yes.
But this sounds like a little bit even more... Like a little more sophisticated version of that
idea. I will
say
it's one of the best first-person shooters I've played.
Yeah, I really love it. And they're also doing they at the end of the game they do a play of the game, which the algorithm picks, and they're working on that algorithm because it's a computer picking it. They're always trying to tweak it and make it better.
Right. It's a replay of some badass kill. Or
it's a replay
like
of some awesome moment. And when it shows a shot of your character, which you can get different versions of when you buy them, and then it shows the moment, and then. It picks five characters who did, like, the most damage or the most healing. The healers are almost always on there.
Yeah.
And your team votes on, like, you get one vote to sort of give them a boost. And they get bonus experience based on that.
Oh, nice.
So if you're a healer, you might get some love from your team for being a healer, and you actually get some experience for it. Or if you did Reinhardt and you protected them the whole time, it'll show you how much damage you protected, and you might get votes from your teammates.
That's cool.
And so
those things that might otherwise kind of get overlooked will actually help you out.
There's no character in here that gets overlooked.
It doesn't encourage you to only play the high kill guys. You don't only play the damage guys, and the healer's the guy that nobody wants to play.
Right.
The healers are cool. I mean, it's still tough somebody's going to have to be the healer, and it's not the most fun role because you don't get all the kills. But
I don't know. I have the healers are fun. Healers.
Lucio, their healer is sort of sound-based.
Oh, I can't get a hang of him.
It's really fun.
I love Zenyatta and Mercy. Those are my favorites.
Yes, and I've had trouble playing Zenyatta. And that's the other thing that's interesting. I've been playing with a bunch of people, and different people have different skills.
Yeah.
Different people learn different characters and are better with different characters.
I was wiping the floor up with this. Soldier 76 the other day.
Soldier 76 is cool. He's their Captain America Cable type dude.
Yep.
Right. A more mysterious, slightly more militaristic.
And I know you've
Cap.
Probably gotten player of the game many a times.
With Hanzo.
But I finally got player of the game with Pharah the other day.
Oh, Pharah's great too.
Because she can fly. Uh-huh. She gets like the super jump where she can go up on top of building roofs.
And then
and
she
stuff
can
like
stay
that.
In the air.
And
briefly.
She can stay in the air briefly. But I found a roof where no one else could get me.
Yeah.
But I was right on top of the waypoint and I could shoot people around.
Yeah.
And no one knew where the bullets were coming
right.
from.
And she's got, she fires rockets. Pharah's great.
Yeah.
She's an Egyptian with a battle suit.
She's like an Egyptian Iron Man.
Yeah. And then Hanzo's my go to. I always like the archers. Japanese Hawkeye. He's got an arrow that lights up the target so that all you see red silhouettes of all the villains, so you know where they are.
Uh-huh.
And then he's got a multi arrow that he can fire that like blasts around the whole area.
Oh, I've been killed by that many a time.
Yeah. And then also you can pull back the bow. You hold your right trigger down, and he pulls back the bow, and the controller shakes to indicate that the string being pulled taut. And then the longer you pull it back, the more damage it does.
Nice.
There's so many good mechanics, and it's such a great design world. I'm sure this is a game I'll be playing for a long, long time. I know when the Battlefront DLC comes out, I'll jump back to that for a little while, but Overwatch definitely has my heart right now.
And honestly, I could see them adding different characters for an add-on pack.
There are. I talked about it. There's new characters coming. Yeah.
Okay. Is there more levels in the, like, that?
I'm sure there'll be more maps. I feel like we've got to go to the lunar base at some point.
Well, that would be cool. Australia.
And Australia. I want to see that.
I don't know if Blizzard knows much about expanding on games.
Yeah, that's true. That's a reasonable point.
But honestly, I think Randy and I are both playing this on PS4. Go friend us. Come play with us.
Yep.
It'll be a lot of fun.
All right. That about wraps it up for us this week. Until next time,
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.